First, there was a re-airing of an interview that Krista Tippett did of the poet Naomi Shaheb Nye on the On Being radio show. And Naomi read her poem, Kindness, during the interview. As I know now, that's a very popular poem about sorrow and loss, but it was new to me when I heard it. Secondly, I recently had the occasion to revisit some of Dainen Katagiri Roshi's teachings on compassion, and particularly the suffering and sadness aspect of compassion. And third, yesterday was the 1 year anniversary of Zen Center shutting down in response to the global pandemic. Since then, worldwide, at least 2.5 million people have died. And in this country, one out of every three people knows someone who died from the coronavirus. I think in this year that we've all been through an evolutionary process and been changed in some way by it, none of us are the people that we were a year ago. Well, the pandemic isn't over, of course, but now there is a sense that we're moving on. And that feels good. And I hope that life will be better for everyone. But I'm also aware that there are aspects of my lifestyle that I've had right now during this year that I will miss. Things like the simplicity of the life that I've been leading. That's not going to last. Things are going to be different. But there's something in me that wants to take a pause just for a moment to honor the inherent sadness and suffering in human life, and to let it tenderize me a little bit in understanding how life is for human beings. So the title of my talk today is Three Sadnesses. And if you just excuse me for a second. Okay, that's better. So the first sadness is radical or root suffering. When we start to study Buddhist teachings, the first thing we usually hear about is the noble truth of suffering. Sometimes I wish that our teaching would begin with the noble truth of our inborn Buddha nature. But I do understand that starting with that teaching might not be understood properly if suffering did not come first. So in our suffering, there is physical suffering, mental suffering, and a third form of suffering, the fundamental existential or radical suffering, radical based on the word root, that exists deep in human life. It is something much deeper than physical or mental suffering. To be human is to bear an innate sadness. The Buddha said, life is characterized by suffering because there is always a kind of silent lamentation inside. We usually refer to suffering with the Sanskrit word dukkha, but dukkha is a very difficult word to translate. Katagiri Roshi rarely used the word dukkha. Of the two books that I edited, the word dukkha appears in only one place in The Light That Shines Through Infinity, where he speaks of it in terms of ignorance. he said, "Eternal life is vast and deep. In the eye of a Buddha, that vastness is very clear. And life is very simple. Just go ahead in the realm of emptiness. But when vastness appears in the realm of human intellect, it becomes blurred. Ignorance means that you are standing in the middle of a world so vast and deep that your intellect cannot grasp it. When your intellect cannot grasp the vastness of life, you become confused and carried away by your ignorance. In Buddhist terms, this is called dukkha or suffering." Katagiri emphasized the need for us to pay attention to this radical suffering. He spoke about it in terms of a deep vibration, a disconsolate flavor that's always present in human life. He said that that vibration is based on the Buddha's teaching of impermanence, which explains life as a series of unique moments in which we exist for a brief moment of time. A moment begins when the unity and formlessness at the ground of being subtly begins to move toward expressing itself as difference. Form appears following a 12-fold chain of dependent origination. Ignorance is the first link on that chain. It represents a subtle movement or vibration that is called avijja, or ignorance in Sanskrit. In the second link, samskara, which are the formative forces of karma, accept that subtle energy and fashion it into the third link, which is vijñāna. Vijñāna is human consciousness. It comes from the root of vi, meaning to divide, and jñā, meaning to know or observe. So its function is both awareness and cognizance, to notice or observe. So although the essential nature of reality is that it's indivisible, the discriminating human mind produced by vijñāna identifies itself as the observer, who is separate from the things that she observes. After that, the rest of the links form beings that exist for a moment and then dissolve back into the original ground of being. Vijñāna is important to understand because the sadness it imposes on us comes from a kind of veil or forgetting of the truth that our individual existence is part of something whole. Sadness appears because although we exist within the unity of Buddha expressed as Buddha nature, whenever we reflect on ourselves through the separating function of human consciousness, we feel that something is missing or lost, and we are incomplete. That sense of lack is the basis of the grasping or thirsting desires that trouble our lives, such as the fear of inadequacy or the longing for affirmation. But fortunately, our inborn Buddha nature sends out little beacons or messages about its existence. And if we're open to receiving them, we start to imagine the possibility of finding a way to experience ourselves as whole. Then the silent lamentation deep inside us becomes a calling to embark on a spiritual practice to find out who we really are. Katagiri Roshi had the slogan, "Relax your frontal lobe." In our brains, the prefrontal cortex includes the cerebral cortex and is responsible for our cognitive processes. Maybe we could match that up with Vijñāna and think of that when we practice Zazen. Let go of our self-centeredness, open ourselves to the spaciousness of our original unity. Let the universal life force restore us to wholeness. Katagiri said it this way: to do this, all you have to do is settle down on the ground of human life and depend on that sadness to be there. Accept it. Deal with sadness. Try to deepen your life again and again. Accepting our separation and using it to move beyond separation is the practice of deepening ourselves. Finally, there's experience of relief. Everything is arising within you as Buddha. The writer Bethany Webster said, "The willingness to feel our essential aloneness carves out a great depth within us that can hold a vast field of love." I'm going to move on to another sadness, but first, here's a haiku poem. This has been my companion in my Zen practice for so long that I don't know where I found it originally. It's written by Taneda Santoka, who lived from 1882 to 1940. He was a wandering poet and ascetic Zen priest for the last 15 years of his life. And this is my way of reminding myself to practice with the sadnesses that come my way. This is the stone drenched with rain that marks the way. This is the stone drenched with rain that marks the way. Excuse me. The next sadness is the suffering of compassion. When Katagiri Roshi taught compassion, he said that the word compassion consists of two terms, Maitri and Karuna. Maitri is friendliness or kindness, and Karuna is sadness or moaning. This definition is a little confusing, but it turns out that in Japanese, the word for compassion, jihi, which I would spell J-I-H-I, is composed of two Chinese characters. Ji is the character for the desire to give happiness to all beings, and he is the character for sadness. Some people say karuna is defined as the desire to relieve others' sadness, but I don't think Katagiri Roshi understood it that way. Katagiri said, "Ever since I became a monk, I wanted to know why there is sadness in compassion instead of just kindness. I didn't understand it. Finally, I learned that to understand it, you have to taste that sadness." And then he went on to say, "Karuna is not the sadness, pain, or suffering produced by your human consciousness or physical senses. It is a deeper sense of pain or pensiveness, a very deep and limitless moan that is beyond words, It is always in our hearts, but nobody can express it. That moan comes from a disconsolate irritation in the bottom of your life. It comes from wanting to get something, wanting to know something. The deep moan is present in everyone's life, a deep and limitless moan that is beyond words. Coming from the bottom of your life, everyone has this moan because we want to know something more than our intellectual understanding of human life. That is why we practice. I don't know if there is exactly a difference between the feeling that he's describing as deep moaning and what he described as the radical suffering at the bottom of human life. But practicing with dukkha was about the pain that moves you from the surface of your life to a deeper place in your life where you can feel the relief of connection and grow in wisdom. But here, in the moaning part, he's saying it's when you experience oneness that you realize how deeply your consciousness is vibrating, constantly creating a gap between you and eternity, constantly separating you from others. And a deep moan of sadness arises in the depth of your life. This is Katagiri's voice. I think we can understand Karuna as that moaning. So this moan is not about seeking oneness. It's about finding it. And from that viewpoint, seeing how clearly our human consciousness operates to keep that awareness hidden from us. And it's also about being aware that you have to return to living in the human world and accepting the conditions it imposes on you, including having a human consciousness. So we cannot ignore or escape that those are the conditions that we actually have to face. But as a way of human life, we can create better, more wholesome conditions from moment to moment based on expressing our wisdom or our understanding in a kind way. And back to Katagiri, he says, if you know the deep moaning of your own life and pay attention to others' lives, someday you recognize that the deep moan is present in everyone's life and your cry turns into great compassion. Then, very naturally, you can share your life with others in a kind way. Even though you cannot explain it, understanding the deep moan in your own life spreads into others' lives and gives them relief. So resuming the everyday life of a compassionate bodhisattva means accepting that you live in a state of separation, which is a sadness, but also creates an opportunity to open your life to others. Opening to others can relieve their suffering, but it also relieves your own suffering at the same time. You save each other because you are no longer completely separated. For a moment, you feel that your life and another's life are one interconnected life, and there is a feeling of love. This teaching on giving kindness to suffering encourages us to not look away from the deep sadness of life, but to see it from a broader point of view. Then we can accept it and use it and follow it back to the truth that is always present and available to us as our Buddha nature. Then we can think of compassion as a practical way of expressing Buddha nature in the human world and respond to things from a deep spirit of togetherness. And as an example of what living like that looks like, I want to tell you a story that I read in the newspaper about Hennepin County Judge Kevin Burke. Kevin was the longest serving judge on Minnesota's district court bench, and he was nationally known and admired when he retired last September after serving for 36 years on the Hennepin County Court. He worked for many ways to make the judicial system work better for everyone. One of his accomplishments was creating the groundbreaking drug court that steered defendants into court-supervised treatment rather than sending them to prison. I read a newspaper article about him when he retired, which said that a hallmark of his career was his commitment to kindness and openness with everyone, from colleagues and defendants to the media. And in that article, his law clerk told a story as an example of the compassion and empathy that he consistently extended to other people. There was a poor young Black defendant that showed up for a felony jury trial in the orange jumpsuit that is required jail attire. Burke then ordered that the defendant be provided with street clothes. But on the day of the trial, the defendant was brought into court wearing his new clothes, but with the telltale bright orange jail-issued flip-flops. No one had provided him with shoes. Without a request from anyone and without fanfare, Burke stepped off the bench, removed his own loafers, and handed them to the defendant. It was unacceptable to him to have the jury get any indication that the defendant was spending his nights in jail. I really love that story, and I think that we were really lucky to have that man as a judge for so long. Sharon Salzberg says that compassion allows us to use our own pain and the pain of others as a vehicle for connection. This is a delicate and profound path. The third sadness I want to say something about is grief. Grief is a huge topic. And I am really not going to try so much to say so much about it today. But I recently saw this question posted somewhere. When someone dies, am I grieving more for myself than for the person whose life has ended? I started thinking about grief as more than the loss of a person, but as the loss of the possibility for something else to exist for us. We might lose someone who saw you in the way you wanted to be seen. And now, will anyone see you that way? Will you be able to see yourself that way? You might lose a future self that you imagined that you would be or could be based on having that person in your life. Or you might lose the happiness and companionship or support that you thought you would have in future circumstances based on that person in your life. My favorite advice columnist, Carolyn Hacks, wrote, "The heart of everything we cry about is what may have been." For example, she says, "It's normal and common for surviving children to grieve both the parent they had and the parent they wish they had had. I experienced something like this when I watched the broadcast TV show, This Is Us. It's a popular and sensitive multi-generational family drama that I follow faithfully. When I see the emotional depth and mutual recognition that passes between the characters within their familial and marriage relationships, I become aware of things that I didn't experience in certain important relationships in my life. Things that I had somehow expected to be there and perhaps should have been there, but weren't. And it feels like I'm experiencing a loss right then, and I start crying. It seems that I'm grieving for something I might have had, and now I never will. But at the same time, I'm aware that I have a subtle feeling of tenderness that opens up within that sadness and expands my feeling of being alive in a deeper, more authentic way right at that time. And I appreciate having the capacity for that. There are other griefs that are not about the loss of a person, such as the loss of a life you can imagine having, but you never will because of where or how you were born, such as your gender or your race or the body you were born with. Or there's the loss of the ability to believe in something or depend on something or someone that you should be able to believe or trust. In other words, the grief of betrayal. A wail of grief went up around the world when George Floyd was killed at the hands of police. And right now, we in Minneapolis and concerned people around the world are following the trial of Derek Chauvin. We're reliving that grief. There is anger, of course, but also a very clear, deep, and profound sadness at the way things are in this country. And here I want to read the poem Kindness by Naomi Shaheed Nye that I heard for the first time last week. Because in it, I think we can see kindness and sadness intermingled, just as Katagiri Roshi described it. And this poem speaks to me about moments when everything falls apart, and then taking it all in and finding or feeling a way forward. And the backstory to this poem is that Naomi and her husband were on their honeymoon in Popayan, Colombia. One day, while they were riding on a bus, they were robbed of everything. And someone else on the bus was killed. They were left with literally nothing. No money, no passports. Everything was gone. So what do you do? Shaheed Nye said, "A man came up to us on the street and was simply kind and just looked at us. I guess he could see the disarray in our faces. And he just asked us in Spanish, 'What happened to you?' And we tried to tell him, and he listened to us And he looked so sad. And he said, "I'm very sorry. I'm very, very sorry that happened." And he went on his way. She said, "We went back to this little plaza and I sat down. And all I had was the notebook in my back pocket and a pencil. And my husband was going to hitchhike off to Cali, a larger city, to sort things out. And I was going to stay here alone. I sat there alone in a bit of a panic, night coming on, trying to figure out what I was going to do. Then this female voice came across the plaza and spoke this poem to me. Spoke it. And I wrote it down. I was just the scribe." Of course, she's not talking about a real voice. She's talking about something that's coming from beyond. So the poem is called Kindness. It's a little bit long. "Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment, like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go so you know how desolate the landscape can be. Between the regions of kindness, how you ride and ride, thinking the bus will never stop. The passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you, how he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive." Oh, makes me want to cry. "Before you know kindness is the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow is the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth." Excuse me. "Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to gaze at bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, 'It is I you have been looking for,' and then goes with you everywhere, like a shadow or a friend." Well, the poet doesn't say what happened next. I really wish I knew. She doesn't say how she carried on from there. But she did say that just writing it down changed it. She says, writing things down, whatever you're writing down, even if you're writing something hard or sad, usually you feel better after you do it. Somehow you're given a sense of, okay, this mood, this sorrow I'm feeling, this trouble I'm in, I've given it a shape. So I can stand back. I can look at it. I can think about it a little differently. I can think, what do I do now? So I just want to end by saying this thought, that we can hold suffering, sadness, or griefs of all kinds in a kind of liminal or threshold space that takes us closer to knowing what is true and shows us how to be a true human being. I think we can honor that truth and leave space around it for the spiritual alchemy that allows a more deeper, more mature appreciation and understanding of life to grow into that space within us. So that's my wish for all of us. And that's what I have to say to you today. Thank you.